Hello, this is a podcast for the Centre for Public Integrity, Australia's leading democracy and research institute established in 2019. With me now is Geoffrey Watson, SC. Geoffrey is a former counsel assisting the New South Wales Independent Commission Against Corruption. He's a director of the Centre for Public Integrity and a teaching fellow with the University of New South Wales. Many New South Wales people know Geoffrey Watson because of his work with the Independent Commission Against Corruption, exposing deep-seated corruption within our political system and government in this state. Geoffrey, welcome.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Geoffrey, I want to talk about your personal experience and what shaped you. I understand if you could just take us through your background, your childhood, your university, your qualifications, and getting into the law, and then finally...
All the listeners will turn off if I get too much into that.
Into anti-corruption.
It's pretty conventional, very nice. I went to a nice school where people were very friendly, and I had loving parents and good sibs. It was all very easy for me, and I did arts and law at the University of Sydney. I was a solicitor for a year, but then I became a barrister, and I appeared quite regularly in the New South Wales Court of Appeal before David Ipp. So one day I got a call from him and asking me if I'd be his counsel assisting in an inquiry. I did a few, and it grew from there. And from there I also did the same sort of job for other organisations, which looked at corruption in the police, etc., etc.
Were you from a lawyer family?
No, not at all.
So what was your family background?
Oh, my family background, I think...
Dad, mum?
What did Dad do? My father was a stonemason. He was a contractor in stone, and, for example, the stone that you'll see on the War Memorial in Canberra. It was nothing to do with the law, but when I was... I guess about 14, I read To Kill a Mockingbird. This is a true story. It sounds corny. I read To Kill a Mockingbird. And I think I think from that moment I was always determined to be a lawyer.
So it's a sort of a Clarence Darrow conversion, was it?
It wasn't a conversion. It was just I read the book and I just thought that's what I would like to do. Now, of course, it's completely unreal to think that lawyers have a career like Atticus Finch. But nevertheless, that was an influential figure. That's why I got into it all.
That's the criminal law.
Of course.
And what's fascinating about that, given the human condition, is the prejudices which lie within all of us?
Oh, look, the criminal law is the key part of our law. I mean, people might think constitutional law is important. Rubbish. The engine room is the criminal law. I always tell my students, that's where it is. It's just that lawyers who are looking to buy a waterfront don't do criminal law because there's bigger money to be made at the commercial end. That's a sad truth of our system. The second most important part of our law is family law. I never went in the family court, either in a personal or professional capacity.
But the criminal law... involves prosecution and defence. So you've been a defence barrister too, haven't you?
Yep.
And you have to take your instructions, what was then called the cab rank rule, and you defended some, shall I call it, unsavoury characters?
Absolutely. There are actually some things I look back on and think, wow, I'm glad I was younger when I did that because I wouldn't be able to do it today. And to tell the truth, I wasn't really very well suited to that kind of work for that reason, because there were times when you started questioning what you were doing. Now, I'm saying I have the greatest respect for the criminal lawyers who go into bat for some pretty bad characters. They do a great job. I respect them. Not really what I wanted to do.
You didn't become a prosecutor?
No, but I have prosecuted, but that's another issue. I did some private ones.
Right. Tell us about your, after IP engaged your services with counsel assisting the New South Wales Independent Commission Against Corruption, Did you look at it as though it was like pulling the wings off butterflies, because it had coercive powers? And if you called me up or you subpoenaed me or gave me an order to appear, I had to appear and bring all my documentation and hand over my mobile phone, and you could covertly surveil me, you could tap my telephone.
Yeah, it's very powerful. You've got to be careful. I'm really quite confident when I say this, that nearly anybody who touches upon this kind of work, Quentin, becomes addicted to it, because it's important. Public sector corruption is a very, very unusual crime, because the people who are committing it are usually in control of the system which they are corrupting. They not only know where the loopholes are, sometimes they created them, they also put in place means of escape. So it's really very hard to investigate it. So the police can't do it. And this sort of organisation, and ICAC in New South Wales, has become a model for other places around the world. It's very important if you wish to undo public sector corruption. Now, when I say that it's an unusual offence, don't lose sight of this. Public sector corruption is the most serious offence in the world. The international drug trade could not function without public sector corruption. And there are all of these incredible estimates put out by World Health, all the economic forums, saying that public sector corruption is adding, in some places, 30% to the cost of living. Now, I know that sounds odd, and that is Africa. In Australia, the figure is much smaller, but nevertheless, it's significant.
Is that because public sector law enforcement, licensing, other regulatory regimes can so easily be corrupted because of the dynamic power of, say, the drug trade?
It's like that, but it works in a myriad of ways, and we would be hours in trying to make up a list. But for example, something in the order of 40 to 50% of all aid that we would provide to starving people in Africa is simply stolen by international criminals. Now, I've used Africa quite often. You want to bring it home. The problem's obviously not so bad, not so rampant in Australia, but it is still bad. The obvious one in the federal sphere is defence. The budgets are enormous. The ease with which you can collude to inflate prices is obvious. It goes on, I'm afraid, every day. And without an agency, a powerful agency, sitting looking over the shoulder of some of these bad people, not necessarily politicians, mind you, it's more problem with bureaucrats, without somebody looking over their shoulder, they're going to get away with it.
But what about the Auditor General under our Westminster system? The Auditors General have got powers to go in and look at the books and trace where the money's gone, and get tip-offs from informants within the structures, the bureaucracy. There are some good bureaucrats who would blow the whistle on, say, bad acquisitions or loaded contracts.
A couple of things in that. First of all, our Auditors General around Australia are fabulous, and they have been, federally, the key anti-corruption body until the creation of the NAC. They've done a wonderful job, but I'll just give you an example. The Federal Auditor General only looks at things in hindsight. It's after projects are finished. Quite often they'll find that something went badly wrong. But their funding is such that they are able only to conduct, it used to be 80, but I think it's gone down from that to something like 70 audits per annum. Now, when you think about the number of contracts which are issued by the federal government, it's in excess of 70 per day. So you can see whatever the Auditor General is able to do is only a tiny aspect.
And existence of a National Anti-Corruption Commission, which you and others at the Centre for Public Integrity work so hard to achieve, you were hoping would change all that. Without getting into the problems of the NAC, which have been discussed elsewhere, it's a cultural thing you've discovered, isn't it? The deeply cynical and expedient nature of the way politics is played in our country, let alone elsewhere.
Oh, dear me. I mean, I was in the room when the federal NAC was being designed and there were some aspects of it which I just couldn't believe were occurring. I've heard people say time after time that it was something which came from the coalition to limit NAC's ability to conduct a public hearing in the fashion that they have. I'm not so sure about that. I think it may have come out of the Labor Party parliamentary party room, because I did meet with a lot of those people. I won't name names now, but one in particular was so negative about it that he ridiculed it. They didn't want people looking into their affairs. That's one of those rare areas of bipartisanship. So I don't, you know, one thing about this is you have a body like a Federal Integrity Agency to try and rebuild confidence in a system. For some reason or another, some politicians saw it as their purpose to prevent that occurring. Nobody will ever be able to explain to me why that could be so.
Tell us about your experiences within the limits of the defamation laws, of course, which guide us all. Tell us about your experience at the New South Wales Anti-Corruption Commission and the use of the coercive powers to search warrant raids, seizure of documents, which, how do you substantiate using those coercive powers?
Do you know what I'd rather tell you about? Yeah. It's my experience while I was council assisting, which quite frankly was horrifying. It was dreadful. People thought at the time that I was in control of things. What they weren't seeing is what I was getting at home. And I know who was responsible for some of this. It's absolutely dreadful. There were things put up on the internet suggesting that I was trawling public toilets for sex, that I had a 13-year-old boyfriend, that I was a regular cocaine user. I can assure you, all of those things are false. I can tell you I've never taken cocaine in my bloody life. They did also say that I drank too much. They might have hit on something there, but put that aside. An awful incident where we live in a very quiet area, in a very quiet street. My wife came out the front door one day to walk the dog, and a man, a big man, got out and walked around about 20 metres behind her whistling a tune. She rang me and said, "This is really odd." And I said, "That sounds actually bad." It happened again a few days later. We've had people follow us. We had dog feces smeared on our front gate. And I know who's done this. They threw rat baits over our fence. We had a Labrador. They eat anything. I tried to kill my dog. I had a car burnt out. And all I can say is that it was pretty bad. I also had a campaign run against me in one of the newspapers, Murdoch Press. I never understood that. You know, whose side are you on? But I look back at it, it was pretty bad. Afterwards, I was sued, as some people listening may know, for misfeasance in public office. Came as a surprise to me because I didn't even know I was in public office, and that's what the judge eventually found. That was by the Obeid family. They sued, and the Australian quite triumphantly said, if they win, they'll recover $300 million in damages. Well, not from me, they would. If they won, they were going to be bitterly disappointed. So it was pretty black and dark and difficult times. And also, I was right at the peak of my legal career where I was getting paid, and look, I'm the first one to admit it, far, far, far too much. But when I went to ICAC, I wasn't. And quite frankly, all my expenses were built up around my previous income. I was only breaking even. So there we are. If people were thinking of GoFundMe account in my name there.
I'm laughing blackly at that experience, traumatic for you and your family, Jeffrey, but how do you build psychological toughness? Because paranoia under those circumstances would be understandable.
Well,
how do you build your psychological toughness as a consequence of that?
You get help. During that time, I was seeing a psychologist on a weekly basis, talking through the problems. She gave me great advice. She said, "What do you want to achieve by this?" I said, "I want to be a calm, polite gentleman." And she said, "Take a sticker and put CPG on it and put it in front of you at all times. Then you'll glance at it." It was a terrible time, Quentin. I mean, I have told very, very few people this. This is, you're a superb interviewer.
What's CPG?
Calm, polite gentleman. And so what it was is just things where she assisted me in taking back control. I can't use on a podcast some of the language that the other barristers, these are colleagues of mine, were using about me during the inquiry. I've never seen such abuse. What happened was that they were whispering it under their breath, but it was being picked up on the transcript. And Commissioner Ipp came in one day and said, look, the people who make the transcript can hear what you're saying. Now, if it doesn't stop, I'm going to get them to put your names on transcript of what you're saying. Now, think of the worst swear words. Yes, they were all there.
So this is what they thought was sort of OJ remarks that were picked up by the transcription.
Yeah.
The automatic transcription.
Yep. But they were sort of OJ. They were for me to hear, but not to
not
go
for the public
the
at large. Yep. But I've always known, having been around the courts in my journalism career, that you barristers can be pretty vicious about each other and your character assessments.
I think you might find that a few people would say that of me too, Quinton. And I mean, justifiably. Maybe I was too harsh. Maybe at times I went too far. But I can tell you, good God, it was an awful environment.
Right, because the stakes are pretty high for the individuals that who were persons of interest. And the lawyers at 30 paces, quite apart from the baits going over your fence, you're sued, as you said. Was that at... were you indemnified, of course?
Oh, yeah. Well, gentle listeners, you paid for my defence. The taxpayer paid for it.
Yeah.
Now, most of the money, nearly all of it, was recovered from the obeats when they lost it. They went crashing and burning down.
And we can't discuss that too much further because matters are still ongoing. What did you learn? Because stakes are high, vested interests are so powerful and formidable, what did you learn about the way power is dispensed in Australia and the political influence peddling that that goes on, which has helped to inform you and the work of the Centre for Public Integrity on what has to be formalised and exposed and hopefully reformed?
Well, it taught me a lot. It taught me one thing is that you can't pigeonhole it. It happens in all ways with all manner of people for all kinds of motives. And it's the most unpredictable affair. Some of the corruption work that I've done, I might say it's gone on. It's people think of associate me with ICAC, but I also did a lot of work involving the police. And I'm currently the investigator into crime and corruption in the CFMEU. I see this all the time, and I can't believe sometimes the incredible small-time criminal mentality of the people who are doing it, who are facilitating corruption for small payouts, $5,000, dinner, tickets to Taylor Swift. You'd be surprised at how easily people are corrupted, how cheaply they sell their integrity. That's always a bit of a shock to me. Then you see the big ones. Then you see the real monster ones. And as you said, we can't talk too much about the obeats, but it's a matter of which of public record that the amounts involved in that inquiry may have been in the order of $90 million.
Right, that's a big amount of money, but the defence acquisitions policy is in the billions, which is the other point.
$90 million is a rounding error when you're talking about defence contracts.
Right, and let alone other elements that were, which you, I think, have indicated at the National, your speech at the National Press Club, were appropriate things for a National Anti-Corruption Commission to investigate. The question, I suppose, is cultural change, and what, how can that be achieved? Is it such? Is the problem such that the human condition will mean that corruption will always be with us until we educate ourselves to how to reject the free Taylor Swift tickets or the free meals or the $5,000 slipped into a brown paper bag?
Good time to ask me. Over the weekend, I reread The Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad. I wanted to read it for particular reasons, and I hadn't. I've read it a few times now. It's a favourite. And so I'm sitting here as an expert on the heart of darkness, the evil that lurks inside the heart of all of us. Look, who knows? None of us have ever been able to explain that, how somebody slips from the good to the bad, from the bright side to the dark side. It happens. But what we do as a community is we build a bond of trust between ourselves and the institutions. And what I say is this, that if you can put in place better safeguards to protect the institutions, then you can rebuild the trust.
That's a lovely sentiment, Geoffrey Watson, but Trump has just been elected in the United States, and all those executive orders he signed with a flourish, with his big black felt-tip pen, included withdrawal of the United States from bribery compliance measures and transfer pricing, facilitation payments, any sort of compliance with transparency for the American corporate sector, indicating that it was an obstruction to business, to the US doing business. And all your righteous concern about the institutional strength is being arguably undone because public support for what I call the Trumpists, to be political in that sense, because there is a movement that around in the United States in particular, and in this country, against the overregulation or the wokeness of what you're involved in.
I'm glad you raised that, because now every time Trump bangs on about Gaza, it distracts people from the other damage that he's doing to the world, and I mean to the world. And one you mentioned is in the area of international taxing agreements, so that there are ways that we prevent companies avoiding tax in countries like Australia by transferring it to other countries. That requires widespread agreement. Trump just took America out of that, and he's undermined that. That was put together by the OECD. It wasn't some sort of woke organisation. This was serious, long-term reform undone with that silly pen of his. We're in dangerous times. Everybody knows that. The idea, for example, that you can govern through these executive orders is completely foreign to the Australian system, which depends upon the checks and balances of the executive, the legislature and the judiciary. And yet here it's been able to be undermined. Our conversation coincides with publication of results demonstrating that Australians, not just school kids, especially school kids, know nothing about civics, know nothing about the way that democracy functions. And when you've got a problem like that, you don't understand when they're taking it away from you. And Mr. Trump, he's taking it away from us.
The question, I suppose, is the antidote to that in not a, just a rhetorical and practical sense, like the maintenance of the trust in the institutions, but was really about the business case for integrity, and that investment in integrity will deliver dividends, both quantifiable and philosophical. You guys in the anti-integrity movement, in the anti-corruption movement, if I can put it that way, really need to be saying this is the business case for integrity and institutional trust.
It's easily made. I gave evidence at a Senate inquiry alongside Richard Dennis, Dr. Dennis from the Australia Institute, who's PhD in economics and knows quite a bit. And he put that forward, and I was sitting there open-mouthed. It's so compelling. The statistics are in. If you wish to improve your nation, you do need foreign investment. To attract foreign investment, there has to be confidence in an absence of corruption in the system. And it's just wonderful how economists have studied this all the way through. The introduction of a federal integrity agency is an important component in ensuring our future wealth. It's just a simple matter of maths.
It's fundamental to prosperity.
Yep. It sounds kind of funny to put forward a business case for integrity, but there you are. It's true.
We'll have to discuss the maintenance of the a sustainable biosphere from the ravages of global warming and climate change on another occasion. But Geoffrey Watson, thanks very much for all you've done, and all the best.
Thank you, Quentin.